mostly what I've seen is these folks are like perfectionists or they care deeply. And so that's really great because it means you set a high bar of excellence. You know, you have a lot of drive. And also that can be your Achilles heel, because if you need to approve every single thing, you need to be involved in every decision. You want eyes on every single thing. Well, now you're getting in the way of your company's velocity. You're disempowering other leaders in the company by growing and taking initiative.
Welcome to another episode of Tools, Talents, and Techniques. And today I am very excited to bring onto the show Ariel Lechner. We talked before about your last name and the pronunciation. Wanted to make sure I got it right. So Ariel, welcome to the show.
You got it right. Thank you so much for having me.
Boom, nailed it. Yeah. So, okay, before we dive into your journey and everything that you're doing now, could you just give us a thumbnail, just a brief introduction on who you are and what it is that you currently do?
So I'm an executive coach. I pretty much work with CEOs, executive leaders, founders who are fed up with the status quo with their companies, with any dysfunction in their teams, and they're looking to create new possibilities and create new results. And so I come in and I help them with that.
So that's a pretty wide net. I think there's a lot of CEOs and executives and founders that, you know, would like to change and would like to get to the next step, but maybe don't know how. And so we'll get into a lot of that. But before we do, could you just talk a little bit about your origin story, the early days of your life and where you grew up?
Yeah. So I'm actually from Montreal, Canada. Grew up there, born and raised. Went to college there. You know, originally I thought I wanted to work in politics. I studied poli-sci. I moved to Ottawa. I worked for a member of parliament. But after 6 months, I was like, this ain't for me. Things, you know, government is great for a lot of things. It also moves quite slowly. And I think I got a hunch that this wasn't going to be the best place for me. And I decided I wanted to get into marketing. And at the time, the place, I mean, it's still, one could argue this is still true, but San Francisco is really the place to be for startups. And I knew I wanted to work in startups. And so I moved to San Francisco. I actually co-founded a social media app with two other folks that, you know, I like to describe it as a mix of like Snapchat and Reddit. And, you know, we got a bit of angel funding, but, you know, no real revenue model, no real, like, you know, some users were signing up, but not sticking. And at the end of the day, after a year, we kind of shut it down. But that experience got my foot in the door with my first proper startup job. And for a while, I was just essentially working on go-to-market strategy. So positioning, messaging, launching, mostly B2B SaaS software products. And I did that for almost 10 years. And, you know, after a while, I started to feel as though this work is great. And also I'm longing for more meaning and having more direct impact with my work. And that is what led me into executive coaching. Certainly, you know, when you're launching products, especially if they're products millions of people might be using, you can have an impact that way. But I think for me, I was really interested in the type of impact you can have on someone's, honestly, personal and professional life through working one-on-one and just knowing myself and my personality and what I wanted to create next. That's kind of how I made the pivot from marketing to coaching.
What year was it when you moved to San Francisco? Around what time was this?
2013.
2013. Okay. So there was still money flying around and people like VC throwing angel funding at people. So
yeah, it was very much like social apps was hot. The app store was still new-ish. It was a different world.
was it when you said, I want to look at startups or that's what I want to be involved in, was there anything that surprised you early on that either good or bad that you're like, oh yeah, this is exactly what I wanted? And I imagine there's a lot of things that you're like, yeah, this isn't very fulfilling. Let me take this pivot.
I think what I always found fulfilling in my work in startups was the team. Like if I, again, I'll speak for myself, working on like a product that might make you 10% more productive in your work is like, cool, but it's not super meaningful. For me, what felt really meaningful working in startups was always the team and the commitment, the camaraderie, the support. Everything always felt very tight-knit. And your work, you definitely see the impact of your work. I've never felt like a cog in a wheel at these smaller companies. Maybe the less surprising but less nice thing was most of the time equity doesn't mean much. Most of the time your equity means nothing. Or, you know, once in a while when a company has a great exit and it's great enough that the regular employees see something. So that was kind of like a hard lesson where people were offering me equity instead of more salary. And I was like, sure. I wish I took more salary.
Well, these are lessons that you have to learn by experience. Sometimes right. People can tell you things and you're like, yeah, but right. You see the big shiny.
The final thing actually that I need to mention in case there's anyone who's working at a startup is options doesn't mean you just own them. You have to purchase them when you leave the company. I didn't know that. So even when I would leave some of these companies, I had to fork over like thousands of dollars to exercise my options. I did not know that. I thought they were just given to me when I started working. These are all the details you learn after.
You live and you learn.
Yeah.
So I want to go back for a second because you went to McGill University, correct? Yes. Okay. So I gotta tell you something. I gotta apologize to the people that I worked at a tech startup for a little bit, had a cup of coffee there. And I didn't know much about McGill University. And we were in a meeting and somebody called it the Harvard of the North. And I laughed because I was like, oh, that's a funny thing to say. You know, it wasn't like a hearty laugh, but just like chuckled. And they were like offended. And I was like, oh, sorry. But then I was educated and I realized that McGill is a very impressive university. And was that experience for you? Do you think, I know there was a stop before you went to the startup world, but did you experience any people with that entrepreneurial spirit in school?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of startups or entrepreneurial people I know who went to McGill who are now doing, you know, impressive things. And also, I think that can be said of almost every school. So when this person chuckled, yeah, McGill's a great school, and also get off your high horse is what I would say to that.
Yeah, okay.
There's a lot of reasons why people choose different schools. McGill is a great place to go. I certainly felt like, you know, if I was an A plus in high school, I remember like my first assignments I turned in and I was expecting like, oh, I worked so hard in this, I'm going to get an A for sure. And then like, I got a B minus on something. I was like, what? It humbled me, which was good because you need that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you being a high performer and going to, you know, an impressive school and having success there, having some success and experience in politics, what did you feel like the performance level of people working in Silicon Valley when you moved to the startup world? Did you feel like it was a high level of performance?
Yeah. You know, in some ways, I know everyone's different, right? But for me, my experience in college was like, I was always kind of studying and working. You know, not everyone has that experience in college, but it's kind of my nature. I was always studying or working on something. I was very diligent that way. So when I went to San Francisco, it didn't feel that much different, you know, having long days, you know, working on something. And mind you, I had nothing, you know, yeah, I would, you know, have fun on the weekends with friends and whatnot, but I didn't have much else going on. Like I was in my early 20s. What else was like, and I, by the way, in San Francisco, I had like four roommates. Being home wasn't fun, and a dog with one bathroom. So I was happy to stay at work and like have peace and quiet.
That's funny. So when you made the pivot, when you started, when you liked working with the team, and that's a big thing, I think, about having life experience and having work experience, you realize what you're good at, what you like, what you don't like, and you did that. Tell me about how that transition happened, like when you made that decision.
Like when I made the decision to go into tech or to become a coach?
A coach.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, earlier in the early days of your career, I mean, you have hunches as to what you like, but you don't actually know. And you only learn what you like by trying different things. You know, I knew I cared about feeling a sense of purpose with my work. You know, that's kind of what drew me initially to politics. I definitely felt in startups, the cultures tended to feel more mission-driven and people felt more connected. That's what drew me there. But I learned a lot about myself along the way working at these companies. And I think the aha moment where I realized, wait, I I need to kind of step back from what I'm doing here was when I realized, you know, I was looking at my boss, the CMO at a company I was working at, and looking at their schedule and like thinking about their day to day. And I thought to myself, that looks awful. And so I think that what I learned about myself is I really want more control over who I work with, my schedule, and the type of work I'm doing. Now that also comes with drawbacks, right? Like working for yourself has its own challenges, right? There's no salary coming in. You have to go and build your pipeline and all this and that. But I think I really was drawn to having control over who I work with, really feeling like the impact I'm having on this person, you know, is profound. And that gives me I get a lot of energy out of that. And then the flexibility and control of my schedule, especially now I have a 14-month-old, you know, in hindsight, I wasn't thinking about that when I got started in this, but now I'm like, woof, I'm so grateful that I got started in this when I did, because having flexibility too when you have kids is a real treat.
Yeah, that's huge. And so congratulations on your growing family. When you look at the coaching and what is needed in the marketplace, is there something that you started off thinking like, this is a gap that executives need to build their team? Walk us through that thought process of what you thought that the coaching experience would be like.
Yeah, I think what I have noticed is you start, again, most of my clients are like startup founders and CEOs, because that's my network and background. And what you often see is these people start these companies, they're brilliant, you know, hardworking people. And what got them to, you know, that saying like, what got you here won't get you there. Or there's being a founder and then there's becoming like a CEO. And that transition is hard for a lot of people because, you know, you're having to let go of things that you used to hold really close to your chest when it comes to work, right? Like if you are a founder with like a strong engineering skill set, your default is to stay in the weeds on like code stuff, which you may be really great at, but as you know, you're raising a Series A, your company's scaling, your company in other ways is now suffering because you won't let go of this piece of the company. So there's that transition. And I tend to focus or work mostly with founder CEOs who are like seed stage to like Series A, Series B. So really from like those earlier times in the company to when it's really starting to scale. And so I'm really interested in partnering with folks in that part of their journey where they're having to, you know, when they're really used to being in the weeds on maybe not everything, but most things, and now having to transition more into leading, setting the vision, thinking about the culture, thinking about communication, and all these different things that, you know, you don't always have to think so much about when you're a team of five.
And is there a common theme that like really holds people back from letting go? Is there something that you see that like you have to work extra hard to pull that apart?
So if you're a founder, mostly what I've seen is these folks are like perfectionists or they care deeply. And so that's really great because it means you set a high bar of excellence, you know, you have a lot of drive. And also that can be your Achilles heel, because if you need to approve every single thing, you need to be involved in every decision, you want eyes on every single thing. Well, now you're getting in the way of your company's velocity. You're disempowering other leaders in the company by growing and taking initiative. It's that like tension between quality or their version of quality, right? Because that's a whole other thing, but quality and like speed. And then what's the right balance and how do we start to shift into, you know, which things might you be willing to accept or do you need to accept to be plus on? To be able to focus on these other things that are going to be higher value for the company long term.
Are there any specific instances that you could take that, you know, you're working with a company, they have these obstacles and they just can't get out of their own way? Is there any instances that you can think of? And you don't have to name names or any people. I don't want to call anybody out, but things that you're like, they just couldn't get past this point.
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, you know, I think what comes to mind is company cultures really form around the CEO. And what that means is whatever the good and the bad qualities that CEO has tend to become part of the culture. And I've certainly seen companies where, you know, the CEO who's very strong and great network, great at building the company, but also has some challenges with giving direct and specific feedback, maybe even a bit of people-pleasing tendencies, that then becomes part of the culture where every employee struggles a bit to be direct and explicit about what's not working. And when you, it can be really hard to disentangle that because now you've hired a bunch of people who are also like mirroring this type of behavior. And if you want a high performing culture, you need to be able to be specific and direct about what's not working. So I don't know if I have like a one specific thing, but I think, again, why I really believe in executive coaching and why I care about this work so much is I really believe if we can, when I'm working with a CEO, if we can address the things that are getting in their own way of reaching their own potential, the downstream effects on the company, on the culture, on the teams kind of fixes itself. Not overnight, but yeah.
Yeah, that I think that's a perfect example. And so I guess my follow-up question to that is how do you, if there are any methods that you use or techniques to help executives see that and work through that? Because it's similar to how you explained actually experiencing and going through these work and life examples. If you can put a mirror up to say, hey, this is what you're doing. And this is right. So like do these exercises or anything like that, that you work with or work through or books that you recommend?
Sure. Books.
Or anything. It's like methods, because and let me just preface this by saying, that makes perfect sense how people can, you know, follow the lead of the person. And sometimes if that person is a perfectionist, the person that's ahead, then everybody else feels like what they need to bring to the table needs to be perfect. And sometimes with a team, I feel like especially if you have a good working team and you're collaborative and you trust each other, then you just do the work, like just advance the ball, like just get it out there. It doesn't have to be perfect, but get other people's feedback, let them in, and then the ball moves forward together. But again, like you have to show that person that this is what you're doing.
Right. So I think what's coming to mind for me is what I would describe as like the foundation of my coaching philosophy, which is everything is an experiment. So the only way of how do we figure out what's true? Well, we might have a hypothesis of what we predict certain results are going to be, but the only way of knowing that is to actually run an experiment and see. And, you know, just because it's something worked for some other founder or in some other company doesn't mean it's going to work here in this context. We need to be, playbooks are useful, and also we need to hold them lightly, because if we're just applying the same playbook everywhere, we can end up not getting the results we want. So if everything is an experiment and we have a hypothesis and we decide how we want to, what's the container of this experiment? What are the variables we're testing? This is really, and an experiment can be something we run, and I work with a client to run like and see over a quarter, right? If we're implementing this new thing with meetings, like let's see after a quarter how this is looking. It can also be something that's done in like a 1 week or 2 week sprint, right? So we can decide how big or small an experiment is. But I think to come back to your question of what are the tools and ways we actually help someone shift, right? Like there's holding up the mirror and helping the client come and see the awareness of, hey, this is how you think. Did you know that? Did you know that you do this? Did you know you're showing up this way? That's step number one. And step number two is then figuring out, okay, what else could be true here? How do we get you new data points to show you that something else could be true? And so to even come back to this maybe example of some resistance maybe around critical feedback, you know, why don't we experiment for this person, let's say in question, experiment with, you know, the next time someone, you know, does something that was suboptimal, you in the moment practice letting them know what was great, and then also what could have been better, like in that moment. Because I think a lot of the times people also like to delay these conversations rather than in the moment mentioning it. That's a tiny experiment, right? They could do that with one person the next day and like see. And it's helping people build the muscle through these experiments, or in this, at least in this example, of doing that thing and seeing that, you know, I was able relatively well to communicate what I needed to say. The other person doesn't hate me. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. That's a lot of the resistance too, is people catastrophize. And so these experiments help people get new data, and then that data helps them shift their beliefs of how they're showing up.
You know, you dropped a couple gems in there, and I want to make sure to put a pin in. And you're the foundation of your philosophy of everything's an experiment. I love that. Because it really is like that. That's so true. And when I feel like when people look at things like that, there's less fear and getting rid of that fear.
Yeah, I actually thank you for saying that, because the other thing I like to talk about too is people attach a lot of fear, or feel a lot of fear to doing some of these things. And I like to mention to folks, like, what if we shift our mindset to thinking more like a scientist? You know, I've never been a scientist, but here's what I imagine about a scientist. You know, their job is literally to run a ton of experiments. And when they run an experiment that doesn't produce what they were hoping for, they don't say to themselves, I'm a terrible scientist. They go, they have curiosity. They go, huh, what about this? Which piece of this did I miss? Or what did I get wrong? And let me tweak it and run it again. And they don't make meaning about themselves as to how good they are. They don't create a story around it. And if we take that lesson or that kind of insight around this think like a scientist, what slows so many people down, leaders in creating change, is this story they make up about themselves, about what the suboptimal outcome means about them. And it slows them down in taking action because they're spinning in this story. And if you can create more objectivity and zoom out from it, you're going to be able to like stop ruminating, stop with the inner critic, and be able to just objectively figure out, what do I need to do next to try to get a better result and move faster? And especially in startups, velocity is everything, right? The quicker you can move, the faster you can learn, the more edge you have compared to everyone else.
Yeah, that's a very great point. And in that same vein, because you said that one, you need to stop and step back. And so do you find that a lot with people that are just go, 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 which is good, like you need that velocity, but how to take those scheduled breaks and kind of zoom out, and how to do that in the best way?
I mean, I think that's a lot of the reason why people seek out coaching, right? Like, I don't actually believe anyone needs coaching. I think everyone is capable of continuing to do great work. I think coaching is something some folks want, because they are very interested in performing at their highest level, and they know having someone, it's very difficult for someone to see how they think, right? It's very difficult for me to look at, I think this way, or I do this, or here are my subconscious patterns. It's much easier for someone to hold up a mirror and show you that this is how you think. And so I just lost the where I was going with that, or your initial question. Remind me.
No, that's okay. So I think when to take time to step back, right, and how to take schedule break, and like why that's important and when to do it.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, so number one, I think that's why a lot of people are interested in coaching. It's this container, this, you know, I would describe almost as a sacred container where there's no hiding. And you're forced to step back from whatever reactivity. And reactivity is especially true in startups, especially if you're pre-product market fit. It's a lot of putting out fires, which is like necessary, but you also need to be thinking like how to get ahead of these fires and thinking proactively and better yet strategically. And so I think number one, coaching is this container to kind of step back, assess like what has been going well, what's been getting in the way, what might I be trying or doing differently to create the result I want? Another kind of, I think through coaching, you naturally build a muscle for this yourself, right? Because the goal is no one stays in coaching forever, right? Like you sharpen yourself to a place where at least for a while, you can then go off on your own, right? You've gained some new skills. And I think coaching is a great place for folks to exercise that muscle and build some strength around it so that they can naturally on their own, whether it's once a week, once a day, you know, whatever feels good for them, to kind of step back and see like, okay, where do I need to kind of take a second and think about where I'm spending my time, how I'm spending my time, and reassess, like, is this the best use? Do I need to make any changes? am I getting in my own way with some of the way I'm showing up with certain things?
You've had your business for a little over 7 years. Is it 7 or 8 years?
Yeah, 2018. So, yep.
So, first of all, congratulations. That's
thank you.
You know, especially because as I've seen in my career, and you know, my wife owns her own legal recruiting firm, and she just got, I think they're 11 years now.
Wow.
But to see that process and see like where they've adjusted and made strategic shifts and where they leaned in on certain things and where they made these jumps at others. It's like, wow, it's amazing how much can take place in 3, 4, 5 years, 6 years. So when you reach 7 years, like that's a great accomplishment. So you should be proud of yourself.
Yeah, thank you very much. I like to also remind people, so I have a referral-based business. I have not done a ton of work around building like a pipeline of sorts. And for me, a full practice is 8 people. So I have a referral-based business. And also, when you start a business, there is no referrals or very little because you haven't coached that many people. And so what I always like to remind people is like my first 2 years of doing this, I shed tears almost every other day because I was like always, oh, I'm 2 or 3 clients away from ruin. Where's my next person coming from? It took a while to build up the flywheel. So I always like to remind people of that.
Oh, and that's it. And you know, that's great. And so that, you know, a lot of our listeners, many work in commercial real estate because that's where the industry I come from. But then also because I worked in startup and I have my own, you know, side startup that I work on and have this podcast. So a lot of entrepreneurs and people. So I think that's really important for people to hear that. Uh-huh. No matter what level of success you think, like it's hard. It's hard. And especially the second year, it's very hard. So to hear you be candid about that and about your struggles is huge. And so I have a question about, you know, the 7 years and especially where startups are now, and especially because you work with, you know, seed to Series A and beyond. So is there the landscape here in 2025, we're in the middle of 2025, and you know, funding has dried up, but a lot of these people that already had funding in their early stages, you know, they're looking for more funding. Is there anything shifted in the dynamic in the industry and that you're seeing that people are?
Sure.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, anyone who is in like the startup space or is a service provider to tech companies, I mean, I think will agree with me or at least agree in part that like, you know, let's say 2020 to, or even like 2019 to 2022 is like flying high, lots of cash, which for downstream for folks like me is like, yeah, people have a lot of money to spend. And then starting with that Silicon Valley Bank stuff, I think things started to, there was definitely a shift in the market. And I, you know, clients having to either shut down their companies because they couldn't, you know, raise the additional funds or maybe acquisitions, things like that. I certainly saw and felt that. I think though, since 2025, there's been like a shift for the better. Things are turning. But yeah, things, I mean, like all markets, things have, you know, there's ups and downs. I think there's obviously a lot of energy now around like AI startups. There's certainly been energy. It's been ups and downs with like the crypto space, which I used to work in. So I have some network in that. And it's interesting to just, see what's going on.
As a startup coach, you know, and you're talking to these executives, do you find yourself being somewhat of a therapist at times too? Talking through with these people that are like, hey, like, yeah, I'm doing these things, but, you know, we need to change things somehow because of the current environment.
Yeah. And it's, well, on that note, you know, what I like to say is there is some overlap. One could say there is some overlap between what a coach does and what a therapist does. It's small, but there is some overlap. And the way I like to frame it is I think therapy looks a lot at the past. And why? Because of the past, you do the things you do. Coaching is more forward looking. So how do we show up in a way that's going to help you create this thing you say you want? Certainly, there is a lot of letting the client kind of, and oftentimes when you're a CEO, this is maybe, and if you don't have a co-founder, maybe one of the only relationships other than your spouse where you can really divulge like your greatest fears and scarcity thinking and all these different things. And I think as a coach, it's a lot of these questions that clients might ask, such as, you know, what do I do? Or how do I get out of this mess? Or these types of questions, they're often unanswerable questions. So I don't know the answer. The client doesn't know the answer. And there is no way of really knowing. And I think in those really difficult moments where clients are coming to sessions with this type of this weight on their shoulders, I'm simply focused on helping them, number one, think of better questions. Like, what is a more answerable question? So rather, how do I save my company? Which maybe is an unanswerable question. We can ask a question that is more answerable, such as, how do I do right by my team while runway is running out? That's an answerable question. We can work with that. So helping them think about questions of how do I want to, in this moment of crisis, how do I live by my values and, you know, do right by my team or whatever's important to them. I help them with that. And yeah, I think that's like one of the most important things is helping them find the answerable questions.
That's a great answer. How do you feel like you've changed since the beginning of your journey to now? Like, what are things that you feel like you're like, this is what I thought and this is where I am. And these are the things that I'm glad I took away from all this.
That's such a good question. Well, as someone who was in marketing before, I never really had to sell myself and like sell. I mean, and I've had other jobs before where I'm like selling stuff, but I was selling clothes. Like, I wasn't selling me. So that was a shift, getting really comfortable with no's. Like in the beginning, I got tons of no's or no's to my pricing or not right now's, and just letting that just fly off my shoulder was like a process that doesn't get under my skin at all now, which if you told me that like 7 years ago, I would have been like, oh, like I was gutted every time I felt like I, you know, didn't hold a session well or didn't navigate a sales conversation well. I think the other thing too is in the beginning, I thought like logos and accolades and all these things were of the utmost importance as a coach and building credibility. And while those things are certainly pluses and they can be useful, at the end of the day, my experience has been people that may help them like start maybe a conversation with you. But at the end of the day, that is, those things aren't how people decide to work with you. They decide to work with you if they feel like you can help them, and that's it. Everything else is like extra. And, you know, that's why with everyone who's interested in coaching, I offer them a session gratis, no strings attached, because I think it's really important for people to experience what coaching is like if they've never been coached before, and also what it's like to be coached by me, because every coach is a different style. And I really use those sessions, number one, like let them know, you know, if we do move forward, here's what you're buying, here's what it's like. And also I get a sense of what it's like to work with them. And that's really, you know, and they can get a sense of, was this person able to add value in like a 90-minute call with me? And I lean on that a lot more than, my experience has been that's a lot more important than whatever like certifications, people you've worked with, this and that. Yeah, I feel like those are the two main things that were really like in my head before I started versus where I'm at now.
Yeah. Well, those two things, and let's talk about this. So being able to take no's and overcoming objections, like real objections, and sometimes it's not the right fit, that's fine. And also knowing your value and who you are, and like those two things together are, it's like a superpower. And you can't have those authentically without experience, without doing it. And it doesn't matter like the names, like you worked with Coca-Cola or like, you know, Ford, whatever, but like whoever it is, like, oh, you know what you bring to the table. And you don't, humbly, like, I don't have all the answers. I'm not the best, maybe, but I'm good at what I do. And if you don't want it or can't afford it or don't like it, like, that's okay. And like having those two together is a superpower. So yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's me developing my own scientist mindset of like every no is like an experiment. You know, it doesn't mean I don't ask myself, what might I have done better? You know, how could I have shown up differently? But also I don't make it mean something about me. And I think in the beginning I would get so caught up in like, why did I get a no?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. And you know, for my sales experience, understanding objectively what the objections were or why they went with that, like, that's great feedback and that's input. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you don't have to take it personally. Like, it's not necessarily that that person's better than you, or they, it maybe just wasn't the right fit or not the right time. And that's okay. And that's okay. But you got to, like, take it, internalize it as much as you can, then let it go.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So is there anything, because you've been very gracious with your time, is there anything else that we didn't cover that you want to talk about coaching or the startup community or just life in general that you want to share with the audience?
Maybe I'll leave with like a mantra of sorts, but this is something my mentor, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year from cancer, but he used to always say, which I think is just the best, which is begin before you're ready. And yeah, I just want to leave that for your listeners. If there's something they're thinking of doing or on the cusp of doing, and they feel like, oh, I just need more information on this, or I need to get better at that, like, those things may be true, and also begin before you're ready.
Okay, wait a minute. We're not leaving on that. Let's dive into that. when did your mentor tell you this? Like, how long ago was this?
I mean, I met him almost at the beginning of my, maybe like 2019, 2020, I would say. Okay. That's when I crossed paths with him. And for like the last 5 years, he's been an incredible mentor to me. He unfortunately lost his battle with cancer, but he wrote a book called Coaching from Essence. His name is Robert Ellis. A lot of my coaching philosophy and the way I approach my practice comes from him.
Oh, I'm sorry for the loss. And, but that's amazing that you were able to take something, and that's like a major takeaway and some of the part of the foundation of who you are, who you show up as in your business, in your practice. So that's special to share. I have one more question though, also, cause I thought about this before, but I was like, maybe I'll come back to that. So you as a mother with a 14-month-old, do you feel like there's things that you've learned in your work, in your career, that add value to your experience in being a mother? And maybe, and I know it's early, but maybe vice versa, the things that now having a 14-month-old that you're like, okay, maybe this is bleeding over into my, yeah, my work personality.
Great question. I have not been asked this question yet. Well, I think from like what I draw from my work experience and how I bring that into like my parenting approach, perhaps, is what are like my 2 to 3 things that are my focus that I'm going like 120% on, that I deeply care about, like my goals, if you will. And everything else is like, you know, B+. So that's certainly, you know, when I've been driving, whether it's in my coaching practice or when I was working in companies, there's always been like, what's my top priority right now? What am I trying to execute against? What matters most to me? And everything else, you can't do it. You learn, especially when you're a business owner, you can't do everything. You can't do all the marketing perfectly. You can't do, like, you have to pick what matters. And maybe those things change as your business or career is shifting, but picking what matters most to you and making sure you optimize for that and, you know, being more flexible with everything else. That's something I've learned from like my work life that I bring to parenting. What I've learned from being a parent and how that I bring that into my work is, you know, nothing's that serious, you know, and everything, nothing's that serious, and everything's a phase. So if something feels hard now, like when he was having sleep regressions, in the moment, I'm like, oh God, this is the worst thing ever. When will this end? And now that whole stage is over and there's something else. And parts of me miss that stage because he was really cute and light. And I think the same is true for work. Like everything is seasonal and cyclical. And if something's like really hard or really good right now, if it's really good, enjoy it. And if it's really hard, you know, it'll be over. It's not going to last forever. And that's something I tell myself as a parent. And I think I bring that too now, like into my work. Like this is a season I'm in, you know.
Yeah. This too shall pass, right?
There you go. This too shall pass.
And have, I think, and maybe in your marriage and your partnership, having people around you to help you see that sometimes when you're going through a hard time. And again, it's just something that I've experienced in my ups and downs, like having people that you value and you trust in your life that you can share things that they can remind you, because it's hard to just like know that, like no matter what you're going through, be like, oh, man, but having people that go, hey, listen, what about this?
Sure.
And like just being there to listen and remind you of that sometimes.
Yeah, I'm trying to, if I didn't have like my husband, or I'm trying to think like my sister, maybe to just like, this day's so hard to kind of like bring me back. It's, I can't imagine if someone's really like with not a lot of support around them. It can be harder to like pull yourself out of that to get into perspective.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you? How can they look you up and get in contact with you?
Yeah, so folks can, I would love to connect with folks on LinkedIn. Search my name, Ariel Lechner. You'll find me. Click connect. I would love to connect with you. And then you can find me on my website, www.newpo.io, newpo.io. And that's where you can find out more about me and my work, you know, folks I've worked with. And, you know, if you're interested in potentially having a conversation, that's where to find me.
All right. And I will include links in the show notes to both of those locations. I guess final question, who you got for the Super Bowl this year?
I don't like football.
No, but you live in Philadelphia.
Go Birds,
you got to say
go Birds. Go
there you
Birds.
Go. That's all you
Birds,
need to say.
But like, I thought, I don't know if you were asking me, like, I have no idea what's going on. It's not the season right now. All I know is when it's bird time, like go Birds to everything. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's the secret to that. It's always bird time.
It's always bird time.
Hey, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me and for the, I loved some of the questions you were asking. Thanks so much.